Are you ready?
Yep.
We will start with a brief statement from each of the Apollo 11 astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and Buzz Aldrin.
Thank you.
And then move right into Q&A. Neil?
This crew has had this kind of session every 5 years for some peculiar reason. 10 years ago, I did make a statement endorsing the concept of permanent presence in space. And I guess that I still feel that's a worthy objective, and I hope that Space Station Freedom becomes a reality before we have another 10 years go by. You know, the only thing that makes me any different from many of you is that I've seen the Earth from a far distance and seen the Moon up close. I think the impressions I get first of the Earth is that it's a very small and a very fragile planet and should be treated as such, a very small object. And the Moon, as I think back on it, I don't really think of it so much as a place as a direction. I think the Moon to me represents out there, and at this stage in the development of NASA, of the space program, I think out there really points to Mars, so that when I think of the Moon today, I really don't think of it as a destination, but as a stepping stone to more interesting places like Mars and perhaps Titan, one of the Saturn's rings. I have some of these, but I'm not going to make use of it. Apollo, to me, was a response to a challenge. It has been termed by many as one of the most audacious endeavors in human history to move outward. About a year ago, I elected to make an effort at putting down some of my reflections as to what I thought the significance was of the putting together of that event and the achieving of it, and it's available in the form of Men from Earth right now. I had hoped that along with that, this situation might be appropriate for this 20th anniversary approaching. Become a catalyst to chart a new course, perhaps because I got caught up in the enthusiasm of the 60s and of achievement that we were all a part of. Perhaps wishful thinking, I felt that this situation would be a very ripe one for the leadership of our nation to chart a course, a bold course for human expansion outward, becoming a bit more specific. I see that that I'm doing some work with the Exploration Office. We're beginning to refine some of the choices, and certainly by the time that the anniversary of Columbus 1992 comes around, I feel certainly we will have a course charted for human expansion outward. I think at this particular opportunity, the 20th anniversary, would be very helpful if we could get some refining of just what the time span might be by our leadership, so that in the interim we could begin to more clearly focus some of the short-term objectives that we have toward the fulfillment of human expansion outward.
Ready for Q&A. Let's start here with John Holloman. Now, please, John, everyone give your name and affiliation before you start.
John Holloman, Cable News Network. A question for all three of you. If
please wait for the mic. We have all the people that are.
All right, Bill Hines of the Chicago Sun-Times. How are you? Or Neil Armstrong. In Houston on the 5th of July, I believe it was, of 1969, I asked you if you had thought of any memorable words to say as you landed on the moon. You said you had not. Then on the 20th, when you did land, you gave us some very memorable words indeed. I'm wondering when it came to you exactly what would be the appropriate thing to say.
You're talking, I'm sure, about L.A. Houston, yeah. Tranquility Base here, the Eagles landed. Well, that was, I thought that was kind of self-evident at the time.
I'd like to hear from each one of you what if you were on President Bush's advisory staff, what would you recommend he do next? What course would you chart to promote the human expansion into space? Would you go to the moon first and then Mars, the other way around, or some different scenario?
The advisory council, which has real recently been reestablished under the current administration, I suppose has that charge, and I don't know how they're attacking it. I would recommend that they not really spend a lot of time reviewing current programs, but they take a longer look so that they can put the policies in place that will establish the programs of the 90s. I'd certainly like to see a gradual evolutionary program expanding outward that includes whatever's necessary moving toward permanent presence in the solar system. I contrast that with going to the moon several times and then essentially pulling back from that for a long period of time. Who knows exactly when we'll get back to the moon? I just don't think that that sort of thing ought to be done to Mars. If we go there, several expeditionary ventures and then not follow up on it. I'd like to see an evolutionary program, and I would see that more than likely involving both lunar exploitation and movement outward toward Mars and the commonality of the equipment that's needed to carry those out.
Sean Boothney with
if you remember, we the early part of power descent were face down, and I might add that we also, because we're engaged in this first rather audacious maneuver of power descent for the first time, we felt that, you know, things could possibly not happen exactly the way things might want them to, so we wanted everything in our favor, and one of those was to be sure that our way home was assured, and that meant being able to catch Mike wherever he might be, and the radar was a little bit more accurate than our eyeballs were, so we felt it only natural to leave the rendezvous radar on, and it was reflected in the checklist. As we were face down, the landing radar was not receiving any information. When we yawed around shortly thereafter, 30,000, 25,000 feet, I'm not sure exactly when, the computer popped out some of these program alarms, which light a caution warning, light the disky display, and give a code as to what it is. And I think it caught both of us unawares. It diverted our attention from whatever else we were doing, and primarily at that point, I was doing a sequential scan of in the cockpit and relaying to Neil what the computer was displaying so that he was able to begin to look and adjust to the scene he was seeing out the window right away. So when things like that happen out of the ordinary, we will get diverted our attention. But fortunately, some of the simulations prior to flight had indicated that perhaps some of the mission controllers needed a bit more information as to what some of those computer overloads or whatever the alarms might be, and they had done some homework on that. I was not aware that that had happened or that something similar to that had happened in a simulation. I think the backup pilot was flying the field at the time. Essentially, it was a diversion of attention, and it involved things that were happening that were beyond our ability to fully comprehend, but fortunately, because all of that information was being sent back down to the ground, they knew the status of things and could make a value judgment that we certainly had every reason to have high confidence in. So it continued to be a bit of a nuisance from that point on, even though it changed from one alarm to the other. I think as the first program alarm occurred at 500 feet where Neil took over manually, it might have caused considerably more concern and diversion of attention. I might also indicate that we were at a significant disadvantage in comparison to succeeding flights in terms of the autopilot that was available to us. It was significantly improved later on in the ability to give this control of the spacecraft back to the computer so that it could null out the motion over the surface to zero or as best it could, and then we could control the rate of descent on down. But once Neil took over, it was up to him to, through changing attitude control, to null out those translation rates. And that's a significant increase in the talent level needed. He was certainly up to it.
Harry Rosenthal, the Associated Press. The three of you became heroes at a time when the United States was very short of heroes and was looking for some, and yet you, Mr.
subject by trying to look to leaders who have been against us. I've more been looking for those that I can rally around behind or to follow me and my thoughts. I don't know. I think that's a little unfair to ask us to point a finger at leaders.
Chip is in fact lacking from a political level.
Well, I think certainly what set us on our course for Apollo to go to the moon has been characterized by most everybody as strong leadership and clarity of purpose in response to a rather unique international and national situation. I think all of us would like to see continued activities in human exploration. Are scratching our heads and trying to wonder how can we recreate something of that nature so that we can maintain or regain or attain what I think we'd all like to see, and that's leadership in the community of nations in the world in what this nation is able to do. We all feel we're up to that, and it certainly takes more than just a little bit of interest here and there. It takes the interest of the people as evidence to the Congress that wants to stay doing what they're doing, and of course they have the first thing, but they're not going to chart a course without the leadership of the executive branch.
Westor, Final Frontier Magazine. Today a lot of people, or a number of people anyway, hold up the Apollo program as a negative in the sense that in thinking about going to Mars, we're urged to avoid an Apollo-type spectacular. And I'm wondering if any of you, with the benefit of 20 years of hindsight, think that we should have done anything differently from the way we did it, and if so, what effect do you think it would have on the American space program today?
Well, I've heard those sorts of comments by others before, and there may be merit and truth to those views. Nevertheless, I am personally delighted as an individual and delighted for my colleagues and our country that even if it was a bad idea, we did it.
Frank Miles, Independent Television News, London. Since one of the main purposes of the Apollo program as a whole was to gather moon rock, and during the course of the six landings, 850 pounds, some 7,500 weights was gathered. And I gather that in excess of 90% of that still lies untouched in a vault in Texas. Would you like to comment, Mr. Armstrong or Dr. Organ?
It may be that we don't have the opportunity to return to the moon in the next decade or two for whatever reasons. During that time period, new analytical techniques and experimental devices will be invented which will allow far more understanding of those samples than we have available to us with our current equipment and techniques. So the fact that we're saving large amounts of that rock for future use, I think, is perceptive and wise. Now, when we hear that people aren't getting enough samples to do what they want to do, well, then one has to balance those two sides, but it's good.
Rally behind the program if the objective of Apollo was to bring back moon rocks. I think there may have been other ways to do that. It was a response to a challenge, and in a sense, that was sort of a byproduct. And the purpose was to demonstrate a capability and hopefully sustain that, and then along with that, accomplish as much information gathering and increasing knowledge and scientific returns as possible. I think if any of those rocks that are
Vida Molinari, Famiglia Cristiana, Italy. How did your great experience change your inner life?
Well, before 1969, the press conferences were much smaller.
He doesn't want to get into that shit.
Dick Giuliano from AP Radio. For Mike Collins and Buzz Aldrin, it's estimated it costs as much as $300 million to launch a space shuttle, and it could cost $30 billion to build a space station. That money could build a lot of houses here in the United States and feed a lot of hungry children. What would you say to Americans to justify the resources that go into space as opposed to being spent here at home?
Well, I'd look at the numbers. We're putting less than 1% of our budget into the space program. I certainly think it's well worth that and more. We could carry out, I think, a very credible, expansive program for less than 2% of our budget. I don't really believe it's up to us to make value judgments as to exactly how that ought to be spent. I think we're expected to be firm advocates for the business that we were in for a good part of our life, and I think we certainly are. We advocate expansion of those space activities as much as possible.
I would just say that it's the responsibility of a government to take care of present needs and to anticipate future directions. And it seems to me that less than a penny on the federal dollar is not an excessive amount to look toward our future. We're a nation of explorers. If we have pursued the logic that says you have to take money from the space program and put it into restoring the cities, we would never have ventured beyond Jamestown or Plymouth, because certainly they were smaller little settlements with problems that dwarf the problems of cities today. And we never would have gotten west beyond the Appalachian Mountains had we decided to render those little colonies perfect before we continued our exploration. And I think that the same thing is true today. Tom Crystal with FrontierNet. Certainly the moon landing, the first moon landing, was a major event of the 1960s. I'd like to get your thoughts on the effects of that event in terms of how it affected how we look at the world and just really the changes that it made in society. The Apollo 11 landing was, in effect, a catalyst to a lot of other things. I'd like to sort of get your perspective on this whole thing that you did out of this one event.
10 years ago tomorrow.
I think it'd be a great understatement to say that it was the most significant event that happened in my life. Professionally, I felt that I was developing myself in an understanding of how one carries out activities through the orbital relationships. So I look back on my participation in Apollo, not only as a crewman, but also as one who had the opportunity to make some contributions in the techniques of how we carried that out. Certainly, it changed my image of myself because of the image that was changed throughout the world of me, and then the ability to perhaps try to live up to that to your standards and my standards was a most significant challenge. I think that right now I'm very satisfied with my ability to project my talents to be very useful to the space program in terms of how we might carry out expeditions and evolutionary missions to Mars. I'm very satisfied with what I'm putting together in that area, and that's where my creative, innovative analysis from orbital standpoint as to how to do that in a really
Linda Scott from CONUS Communications. Aside from the changes in your personal lives, what do you believe was your most important contribution to the manned space program?
That I was
responses to various kinds of failures and abnormal circumstances. And I think we felt fairly comfortable with most of the kinds of things that might happen.
The
ones you worry about are the ones you didn't foresee and didn't properly prepare yourself for.
I would say flying to the moon is a long and delicate daisy chain of events. Any link in the chain, if it gets severed, ruins the whole thing. The one that it wasn't feared was mistrust. The one that I mistrusted the most was the rendezvous part. That was the thing that was on my mind primarily, was freeing these two vehicles, freeing this ungainly looking critter back up from the surface.
John Getter, KHOU-TV. Gentlemen, I think what we're all struggling to try to explain here, maybe you can help us with, is an understanding of what was different then from what is now that allowed the whole world to get behind such a project for a short time. Is it simply that the Russians aren't as bad a guys as they used to be, that we have done this, that we don't have a dynamic president in the White House? Is it some combination? Is it just the times? What? And I'd be curious to hear from all of you on that.
Difficult to categorize, I'm not sure that I am better able than any one of you to respond to that question. We all search for ways to make the right decisions and encourage the enthusiasm and support of the public at large for those right decisions. There's some other thoughts that might contribute to your answer.
I think we all sense what you're trying to point at. Those years that were ripe for a commitment of that nature in the 60s were ones of international uncertainty perhaps a bit of a questioning of where our technical competence was relative to some of the unknowns, what exactly what the Soviets were able to do, then. A lot of that certainly has changed now, but I think we all sense that there's an exponential increasing of technology and capabilities to do things, and certainly space is a challenge to go out there, and I think just naturally we would like to expect responses to come to that challenge of the frontier, the cutting edge of technology demonstrations, to respond with a significant of growing series of achievements. And that's a difficult thing to respond to because the capability technically does exist to do a lot of things, but also their price tag begins to go up rather significantly. That tends to put things a little bit, space them out a little. But once establishing an expectation of interesting, significant achievements of technology in space, I think we all just naturally like to see them continuing on in some fashion.
Well, the world in the a lot more complicated than the world of the 60s, at least in this country. President Kennedy said that we were going to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. That was his goal. President Bush, whom I consider to be a president as dynamic as Kennedy, precipitating events that caused Apollo to be launched that do not exist today.
Max Gomez from KYW-TV in Philadelphia. Let me try to put a slightly different spin on that same question and see if we have any better luck. You've all expressed some significant support for an expanded role of America in space exploration and a permanent place in space. The public, I think, the problem is they don't understand exactly why is it important that we continue to explore. And is that important for America? Is it important for perhaps mankind in general to continue to explore? And then just as importantly, because it's part of the argument that keeps going back and forth even within NASA, does man need to be a part of that exploration?
Long question. Certainly, don't view as manned flights and robotic or unmanned flights as being adversarial in any way. That Magellan probe, to the surface of Venus, has gone places I don't think any of my colleagues or myself want to go. And similarly, with Galileo, that will go places where man will never go, or I have great difficulty in visualizing man going those places. There are places that are limited to robotics. They're the only things that can do the job. On the other hand, at this juncture, their ability to analyze unforeseen events is limited. Man can be amused and amazed, and a robot can be neither.
But I think it's a good question and a fair question and probably the question, and it is, what is it about exploration? And I think it's just inherent in the human condition. I don't know whether we have an exploration gene or whether it's something that we acquire. I think we have a curiosity gene, and that's very, very close to exploration. But people have always gone where they've been able to go. Some people have. Some tribes have been happy to stay in the rainforest. But if you go back to the literal nations of Western Europe, they've always had an obsession to go out to the far corners of the globe. And it's just inherent in us. And I think particularly in this country, we're a nation of explorers. I mean, we've started on the East Coast, we went to the West Coast, and then vertically, I mean, starting with the Wright brothers, the Jaegers through the sound barrier, Armstrong and Aldrin on the moon. It's in our tradition, it's in our culture. It's a fundamental thing to want to go, to touch, to see, to smell, to learn. And that, I think, will continue in the future. Yes, hell yes it is. Part of the human condition.
In the last year, in doing some research with my co-author for Men from Earth, I've been able to reflect a lot more and to verify in my own mind just how much of a continued space race was going on. And even though Glasnost has not opened up confirmation of exactly what the true nature of the Soviet lunar landing program was, it certainly seems conceivable to me that something akin to a Challenger could have opened the door to Leonov and Sevastyanov being known as the first two individuals to be on the moon. And I think that our space program, had that occurred, would have had a bit more continuity to it between then and now in trying to continue to catch up. I think the international situation and a position of leadership as we view nations beginning to catch up and in some ways surpass us in their abilities in space achievements. Certainly the French, Japanese, and Soviets are moving into capabilities for manned exploration in the future. And I don't think we can be followers as long as it appears now to take, to put something together to be responsive. The fact that we could respond so rapidly in an 8-year period from a challenge to do something that was very nebulously understood to be able to achieve it, it seems to, projections now seem to take a good bit longer, so catching up would be more difficult. So I think leadership is one where we need to be on the cutting edge to be able to do what we choose to do in the future.
Okay, we're going to take a question. I understand we have from our overflow auditorium down on the 5th floor. If you will state your question, name the floor.
Yes, Chris Rocher with Scripps League Newspapers. Question out three of you. If you could relive one moment of the mission, which moment would you pick and a brief reason why?
I didn't understand.
If you could pick one moment of the Apollo 11 mission to relive now, which moment would you pick and a brief reason why?
I guess I would pick a moment when I was looking out the window and looking at a full Earth from a long distance. I'm most aware of my observational limitations to see exactly what's happening in rapid pace events, and I'd like to replay again by being there the last 20 seconds, 10 seconds before touchdown, and 10 seconds after. I'd just like to run through that again.
I remember most vividly the picture of the lunar horizon and the limb ascent stage in the foreground with these two guys in it, and then the Earth popping up at that instant. So you have all three lined up. You got the 3 billion people over there, 2 people here, and that's it. That's what I remember.
The one behind the camera
had the foresight to record it on film.
I understand we have one more question from down below. Is there a question from the 5th floor?
My name is Jeff Neesmith. I'm with the Cox Newspapers. Strong, your experiences have excited millions of people. Yet it seems like you're kind of bored and even a little resentful sometimes of the excitement other people feel about what you've experienced. Why do you suppose that's true? Why do you think you leave that impression with people?
In your eyes. That's not the way I feel, but
no wonder he was in
your perception. I'll ask you to explain it to me.
Howard Benedict, Associated Press. There were some reports that the original flight plan called for Buzz to be the first man to get out and walk on the moon. And Mike Collins, in his book, Carrying the Fire, mentions or hints at a dispute between Neil and Buzz over this. In fact, he mentions a particularly stormy night when you over a bottle of scotch to settle some of your disputes. Was there a dispute between you two over who should be the first on the moon, and how was that selection made for Neil and Buzz?
Well, both of these gentlemen have written on that subject, and I haven't. So I'll just tell you that although they may or may not have known what my feelings and facts were at the time, that I had zero input, no input whatever into that decision.
WRC-TV in Washington. We'd like to get some fresh voice tape for voiceover for all that video you sent back to the moon. I wonder if the three of you could even
what I just did.
When you first came in there, when you first came into lunar orbit, and you realized you were really close to making history.
I don't know.
I think the reason I selected those is because there were events happening rather rapidly, and I could tell you that my feelings were, gee, golly, fantastic, is this really happening? And, but no, I knew I was there. I was trying the best to be as receiving a human as I could. Why? To savor the moment so I could tell you about it afterward? No, to respond, if needed, to some requirement on my part to be responsive. In general, I think when things were happening in a hurry, that was our feeling, our sense.
Not certainly understand the question, but I'll answer anyway. The touchdown itself, from my point of view, was a real high in terms of elation. Not so much for the instant, but because it marked the achievement that a third of a million people had been working for a decade to accomplish. And it was a feeling of, we, third of a million people, managed it.
Vincent Del Giudice, from UPI. Had America kept going to the moon over the last 20 years, would we have seen, in your gentleman's opinions, manned colonies there, perhaps an observatory of some type? And what is the feasibility of establishing a moon-based telescope and perhaps colonies or even cities on the moon?
That's largely hypothetical kind of question, but had we had a continuing lunar program over the subsequent two decades, I'm sure that we would have devised habitable modules that were enjoyable and processes for developing lunar resources, extracting oxygen from the rocks, and hopefully finding hydrogen, which is perhaps the most missing element of hydrogen carbon. Very rare up there, would have developed a lot of science in the time period. Would it have cost a lot? Probably.
Maybe we weren't aware of it, or I wasn't at the time, but I think the signs were clear to those in management that by the time we reached there, there was an ending Apollo program somewhere downstream in terms of the number of landings that we could accomplish. And I guess an option is to stretch those out over a period of time. And that generally costs a good bit more. Hindsight or retrospect is always you're treated to be more brilliant than looking back on it. Certainly, I think we did the best at the time with what we had left. We flew Skylab, a remarkable achievement, and a great opportunity. I think it was overshadowed by the fact that we continued on landings, and it was a bit of a letdown. But to have built two of those and flown one and then allowed it to burn up, when we now look at the difficulties we have gathering together the funding, the support for something of a smaller volume, maybe less achievement, we certainly shouldn't have let that one come down. We should have flown the second one, and I think the course of the space program would have changed enormously had we done that. I'm sure that we would have liked to have continued on and established a particular base, including a telescope on the far
Congress Television. A question to Mr. Aldrin and to the other two gentlemen also, regarding more the future than the past. What do you think that the 20-year-olds of today know about your expedition, and what do you think the impact of your great enterprise was on the new generation? And do they know about it? How do they feel about it?